Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his 2003 book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, author Tracy Kidder profiles Paul Farmer, the high-profile doctor fighting to help the world's poor. Now, Kidder is back with a new book. It's about Deo, a genocide survivor from Burundi, whose improbable journey leads him to the halls of Columbia University and back to Burundi to help his beleaguered home country. The New York Times calls the book truly stunning. This hour on Point, author Tracy Kidder tells us Deo's story in Strength in What Remains, a journey of remembrance and forgiveness. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine coming to America with $200 in your pocket and not speaking the language? Is this your story or the story of a relative? And joining me now in the studio is Tracy Kidder. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonfiction writer and, as I said, the author of Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Soul of a New Machine, another book, and Hometown. His new book is called Strength in What Remains, A Journey of Remembrance and Forgiveness, and you can read an excerpt of it at our website at onpointradio.org. Tracy Kidder, I want to say it is a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about Deo Gracias. That is his first name in full. It means...
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God. It's a beautiful name. And his last name?
He'd asked me not to use his last name.
Fine, then we shall not. And also... tell us, before we even begin talking about this extraordinary story, Burundi is in East Central Africa.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about its geography.
It is just the country just to the south of Rwanda. Across the lake is the Congo, and it's also adjacent to Tanzania.
And so it sees this terrible violence in the early 90s. But you have divided this book into roughly three sections, where we begin with this young man coming to America. And, you know, there's a resonance in that because so many of our own ancestors, of course, have come here. We don't know exactly what has happened to him for the first third of the book. We just meet him.
Right.
Who is he?
Well, he was a young medical student. He's a Tutsi. That is a member of the minority, which in Burundi, by the way, was the ruling minority. Well... that's inaccurate. Really, it was a military dictatorship composed of
Tutsis. But they had power over.
They had power. But he grew up, I mean, he didn't have any shoes until he went to high school. But the fact that he did go to high school indicated some privilege, but also great ability. Just a very bright young man who grew up in a loving, big loving family, spent most of his childhood herding cows, making these impossibly difficult journeys over mountains to carry food to cow herders or food up from Lake Tanganyika to back to his hometown.
And enjoyed a period of stability he was lucky, just about the time he was born until he was, roughly 20 or so.
Yeah, but stability with a great
small
strife under the surface. He was born, I've forgotten exactly now, but in 1972, something truly horrific happened in Burundi, a genocide of Hutus, of intellectual Hutus, of any Hutu who, a selective genocide, anyone who could possibly have been a threat to the powers that be. And that included some school children. The numbers are always kind of vague, but it might have been on the order of 150,000. That's what some of the histories say. After that... discussion of ethnicity was impolite, certainly in Deo's family. I questioned him really closely about this. We went over and over it. But he grew up largely unaware of this horrific ethnic division in his country. I believe him. I have to believe him. It is strange. And then there was a sudden awakening for him in 1988, where there was another... The pattern was of an uprising of Hutus, and which was often brutal, bloody, and then a much more savage reprisal by the army.
I will get to that point in the next segment of our show here. But and thank you for that background, because I think it's important. But and we're so drawn in. You're inside his mind from the moment he arrives at JFK, and I'm thinking, I can't believe that somebody could even get into the country as easily as he did.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but after that, it's not easy at all.
No. But this wasn't, this was pre-9/11, and he did have a valid visa, although it had been obtained under false pretenses.
It's 1994, I think.
1994, this, yeah, May of 1994. And he got in partly, I mean, a lot of people didn't treat Dale very well on his journey, but he did receive, as they say, the kindness, a lot of kindness from strangers, including a guy, a baggage handler who was Senegalese, who spoke French and helped him get through immigration. But yes, after that, it was difficult. This same man invited him home, but home was an abandoned tenement in Harlem. And then when his protector, the baggage handler, left, a guy named Muhammad, Dale was alone in Harlem, and he was robbed once, and he got very frightened. He ended up living in Central Park, which he found more salubrious. He eked out a sort of existence delivering groceries for $15 a day. His first trip on a subway, he got lost for almost an entire day. I redid that trip with him. It was really...
Oh, you talked about it. I mean, rivers, and I thought about it. It is what it is. You know, just the rivers of metal going past you.
You're right.
Down in the bowels
right.
of the city.
Right. And then he got lucky. He was feeling pretty close to despair, I think. His dreams felt like ashes. I mean,
he'd been delivering groceries for $15 a day. I couldn't believe that sort of...
Right, and here was a guy who had dreamed of becoming a doctor and a doctor to poor people, a builder of clinics back home. And it just looked like everything was gone for him. And then one day, feeling very sick by this time, ill, he went to an Upper East Side Catholic church and met... And this woman received him there, ex-contemplative nun named Sharon, and Sharon took him on. This is a remarkable woman. I don't want to try to describe her because I wouldn't do her justice. I've never enjoyed writing about anyone more. I think if there is such a thing as a holy person, she is a holy person. But she just decided Dale needed a family, and she set out to find him one.
And didn't give up. And she'd been working at,
at
St. Thomas More Church. And he thinks that maybe she has some sort of money or something. She's so interested in him. He wants to give up. He wants to just lie down in Central Park and never get up again. Mm. And she won't. And then when he sees how she's living
almost like a homeless person herself.
Yeah.
By choice. But taking care of all of the needy people that come by the church. And eventually she found a couple, quite remarkable, a sociologist who once described himself to me as a reformed academic and an artist, a really wonderful artist, Nancy and Charlie. And they took Dale in. I mean, they did it after due deliberation, a lot of deliberation, and then as I understand it, sort of they decided to take him, then sort of changed their minds, and then Sharon called them to say that she'd found a place for Dale. It was a halfway house, and he would have to live there. He'd have to go to group therapy sessions for problems he didn't have. And Charlie remembers saying that's too much for us. Bring him down.
Could you read a little bit? I think it's on page 6. A little bit about Dale arriving.
Certainly.
In New York.
Dale had grown up barefoot in Burundi, but for a peasant boy, he had done well. He was 24. Until recently, he had been a medical student for 3 years at or near the top of his class. In his old faux leather suitcase, which he had reluctantly turned over to the baggage handler in the airport in Bujumbura, he had packed some of the evidence of his success, the French dictionary that elementary school teachers gave only to prized students, and the general clinical text in one of the stethoscopes that he had saved up to buy. But he had spent the past 6 months on the run, first from the eruption of violence in Burundi, then from the slaughter in Rwanda. In geography class in school, Dale had learned that the most important parts of the world were France and Burundi's colonial master, Belgium. When someone he knew, usually a priest, was going abroad, that person was said to be going to Iburaya. And while this usually meant Belgium or France, it could also mean any place that was far away and hard to imagine. Dale was heading for Iburaya. In this case, that meant New York City.
And taking with him memories. I love the depiction of the grandfather, Longino, I think is his name, and the long-horned cows that
yes.
you attend, and his aspirations, which were to become a doctor.
Yeah. It was, in some ways, a lovely childhood, an arduous one, to be sure. But he had a very strong father, and he had a truly extraordinary mother. a woman who could neither read nor write, but in a way was the moral center of their village where they grew up. And during the Civil War, which in Burundi lasted for 13 years, only ended, a few years ago, his mother really was the glue of the whole family. And I think he got a lot from her. I think he shared a lot with her, just genetically, perhaps, or emotionally, anyway. Mm-hmm. Both rather emotional people in a very laconic, stoical culture, she was very generous.
Well, you call this a book of remembrance and forgiveness, and it comes to that. But one of the things I think that I liked about it so much was that at each turn, this is sort of like Pilgrim's Progress, at each turn, there actually are people who help. And sometimes we get so cynical about human nature.
I know. Well, I wish there were more people like those people. I'm not sure I could have done what Nancy and Charlie did.
Well, the Wolves send him to Columbia University after he aces a calculus test. Yeah.
Well, they sent him to the ESL at Columbia, and then he went to the School of General Studies, and he did very well. He did well. I think he went. They paid some of the tuition, and he got loans and some scholarship too.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Tracy Kidder about his new book, Strength and What Remains. Tracy Kidder, we were seeing Deo through his arrival in New York, really tough. He's sleeping in Central Park, but he does befriend a former nun and then this American couple who help him go to school, although, as you were saying at the break, he did get scholarships and grants. Very interestingly, the first part of this book reads like his kind of dreamy confusion about being here at all. He occasionally can call back to Burundi on a payphone on the corner in Harlem, mm-hmm. or take a shower because some Senegalese people give him access to it. He's homeless. Things improve. But then you take us to Burundi itself, and that is where you think, oh, we thought the hard part was living in New York, mm-hmm. like that, when the hard part, the almost unimaginable part, is what you reveal in Burundi. And I have to say, I thought it was the most remarkable writing about violence since I read John Hershey's account of Hiroshima.
Well, thank you. He once said to me that New York was a different kind of hard. He said, "No one was chasing me with a machete. Now it was my mind's turn to run." And the whole second part of my book is really about memory and the torments of memory. But it is true, of course, that the most dramatic and awful part, took place in Burundi and in Rwanda. Because when he escaped from Burundi, he escaped to Rwanda, where 6 months later the genocide began.
Well, let's go back to, we had said just at the beginning of the show that for a long time, as a younger person, young man, he was relatively free of this sort of seething ethnic tension, but which wasn't always seething, but it was by the time he was a third-year medical student. Mm-hmm. And things are going on at this medical school. It's remarkable to him that he's made it in at all. We would consider it, just incredibly primitive. But he's beginning to hear a sort of, this is in the capital of Burundi, am I pronouncing it right, Bujumbura.
Bujumbura, yeah.
And he witnesses these odd gestures of solidarity between student friends. And somebody also, I'll talk about the newspaper in a moment, but what's going on? These are medical students.
These, I think, were political gestures. No, these weren't being exchanged among medical students. I think they were, should I read from this?
Yeah, would you?
Deo began to notice what seemed like a new fad around the university and in the city. He would be out walking with student friends, often a mixture of Hutus and Tutsis, at least as far as he could tell, and they would encounter other friends or strangers who would raise one hand to the top of an ear, then make a fist and raise the hand higher, saying as they did this, "Inivo Nugutwi," which Deo meant at the level of the ear, and then they might say, "Oh, hi," Deo and his friends would laugh and repeat the gesture. Once in a while, he would be sitting with friends on the wall outside the medical school, or on the grass outside his dorm, or he'd be standing with friends on the street, and strangers passing by would smile and say, Susuruka, warm them up. He interpreted these as just new sort of friendly gestures, and I imagine that many of the people who were with him did too. They had some special meaning for some of the people, evidently, who were delivering those, you know, that greeting and that fist-raising gesture. It's all very confusing because there was a political campaign going on. The first real free and fair election in Burundi's history, presidential election. As Deo himself said, you know, it's a chaos. It's not like in football with one team here and another team here. Everyone thinks, you know, remembers it according to what they saw or heard, mm-hmm. you know. This is just a very particular version of these events. The whole first part of this book is the best job I could do in recounting the Deo's memories as he recounted them to me, and we're still there.
Well, the fact that these gestures are going on, he's also been handed something horrific that's in a tabloid newspaper,
yes.
Called the Hutu Ten Commandments. He's beginning to be aware that really ugly things are being said mm-hmm. and being prepared.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't know what he can do about this, and he wants to be a medical student. And then on one day, it's in October of 1993, I believe, everything changes. What mm-hmm. happens?
On that day, a Hutu named Didaje had been elected, a man of peace, most people tell me. He hadn't been in office very long, though, when... And no one knows exactly who, no one has proven exactly who ordered all this, but a faction of the Tutsi army assassinated the president. And there was this enormous upheaval throughout the country. It's still the whole nature of it, which is really the beginning of the Civil War. The whole nature of that upheaval is still vexed, debated, but, you know, it ultimately killed an awful lot of people. And that number is also debated. There were reprisals of Hutus, you know, going after Tutsis just because they were Tutsis, and then of course the Tutsi army came in and did its usual thing, killing lots of civilians many of whom were simply trying to run away. It was a horrible little blood, but not a little horrible bloodbath.
And not long thereafter, Deo is in the hospital or in the school.
The
next morning, yeah.
And something's wrong, but he doesn't know exactly what. You know, he hasn't heard the news. This hospital where he's working as a sort of intern is way out in the countryside. He doesn't know anybody out there, and he goes. He suddenly is told by the brother of a patient. What's going on, and then
get out of here.
And then all hell is starting to break loose.
Yeah.
I mean, I really mean that. And he ran back to his room. Many people were running to their rooms and slamming the doors and locking them. He ran to his room. He was so scared, so unhinged that he forgot to close the door. He crawled under his bed, and that's why he survived, because he didn't close the door.
Let's be with Deo under that bed for just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy, I think it's on page 115.
Yes.
Because you have gone to the trouble of writing this so with
Thank
such
you.
Clarity and tenseness, and there's no, let's actually read it.
Okay. He had lain under his bed, covering his ears with his hands, but he could not shut out the noise that was reverberating down the tall, narrow hallways outside. At one moment he thought, oh God, where do I go? Should I get up and close my door? But he was too scared to move. He heard metallic crashes and realized these must be the sounds of militiamen throwing their shoulders against doors that were closed and locked. The sounds of smashing glass had to be militiamen bursting into rooms from outside. Noise seemed to be coming from everywhere, and then he heard loud voices right nearby, just outside his doorway. He uncovered his eyes for a moment. Two pairs of ragged trouser legs and bare feet stood in his doorway. A voice said, "The cockroach is gone." He ran away. Then the trouser legs and feet vanished. He heard drums and whistles. He heard male voices chanting what sounded almost like a song, one he'd never heard before. But some of the words and phrases were completely familiar. Susuruka, warm them up. And a phrase that meant get them soaked and toss them in the fire. And inivo nugutwi, at the level of the ear. There was singing and laughter echoing from all directions in the narrow concrete hallways, and screams accompanying them. He peeked toward the doorway and saw a small child run past, back and forth, several times, making frantic cries. Then a commanding voice yelled, "Clean up!" The child's cries ceased.
And Tracy, this is where we begin in this section of the book, to go with him into this. And this is what I mean about your writing and the patience and the horrifying time we spend with him. It's a pilgrim's progress through hell, mm-hmm. is what I was thinking. And you wonder how people survive, and in some ways he staggers from place to place.
Yes. He waited till the hospital had grown quiet, until nightfall, really, and then he got out of there, slipping and sliding over corpses, and ran down into a river valley. And then for the next 6 months, he made his way on foot during the first week or so, he's not sure, through the countryside and ended up at the border of Rwanda, where he was saved, incidentally, by a Hutu woman who terrified him at first. And she said, "I know what you're thinking, and it's right, I am a Hutu," she said, "but I am a woman and a mother first. That's my Ubuoko, my ethnicity." And she helped him across the border, pretending he was her son. You know, it's not all that easy to tell a Hutu from a Tutsi.
They can't even tell each other.
Sometimes they can, and certainly if you live in a village, you can. But this is a very there's a huge history to this, and I do get into it in my book. I don't think we could even begin to attempt it now. In any case, he crossed the border, and most of the people, almost certainly the hundreds of thousands who crossed the border from Burundi into Rwanda, fleeing the certain reprisal from the Tutsi army, were Hutus. Whether there were any Tutsis mixed in or not, it's not clear. There were these open-air refugee camps, and Deo languished in those for months, but moving from one camp to another whenever he could, because after a while every camp started to seem dangerous. It was a really tense time. And then he was feeling pretty sick, emaciated. He had, on his escape, he'd been wounded once, and I guess he just was he was having terrible intestinal problems.
Well,
which he could diagnose, but could not cure.
But couldn't treat. Yes, and you take us through each seeing as he had to see it, a family that's been partially dismembered, a baby dies, on the way, things that will in fact haunt him. I definitely want to invite our listeners to talk about their own stories of refuge and place and finding a new place in this country. But Deo, and we will do that in the next part of the show, Deo, of course, isn't thinking like that. There's something you are very much able to be in the moment with him, and he says something like 6 months felt like minutes, and yet a moment felt like forever. Time
shifted completely, as he explained it to me. In any case, that you know, there was no time to reflect on the past. There was no occasion for it, and he was pretty much confined to silence because he didn't want to talk and give himself away or ask questions. So it was as though there was no time in a way. I forget exactly how I put it, but it was the way he expressed it to me, that you didn't think more than a minute ahead because you weren't sure there was going to be anything beyond that anyway. And besides, it all felt so perilous, you know.
How did he manage to get out of there?
Well, when the genocide in Rwanda began,
he's now in a camp there.
He's in a camp, but the camp began to scatter and to split up. And he went with a bunch of people. He didn't know what ethnicity they were or anything. But there were these, for a while, there were these Interahamwe, with Rwandan militia, genocidaires, who were urging people to go to a place called Murambi. It was the site of a very large technical school. And he went sort of along with the crowd, and I mean, his memories of this, of course, have grown indistinct. We did go to that place, he mm-hmm. and I, but at some point, he found himself among a crowd that was surely mostly Tutsi, and they were all rushing to this place. And huge crowd, he could see, was gathering on this sort of promontory. And for months, crowds had been his refuge. And now it occurred to him, suddenly, crowds are dangerous. And he did not go in. He skirted this place, and in the middle of the night, he heard, I think, the dates get a little confusing, but he heard the beginning of the huge massacre that took place in Murambi. Something on the order of 50,000 people were slaughtered there. He then made his way back toward Burundi. And it probably took him a week or maybe more, traveling mostly at night. Following, when he could pick up the road that goes to Burundi, this main road, he'd stay at a distance from it, but it helped to guide him. And finally, he got to the border river. There, the Burundian army was, and they gave him a ride back to the capital city.
It's just an opportunity, if I can put it like that. We are so often reading about these things, or as journalists even reporting on them, and one of the great frustrations is always that you know it's fragmented. You've taken a bit of a person's story without knowing their history, or you've got the history, but that doesn't fit into your short window of story. But by looking at Deo's entire journey like this, we're able to see all of it, and including somebody who somehow thinks for himself, and I really want to ask listeners about this, who survives because at each turning point, it's a little bit of luck and instinct, a lot of instinct. He doesn't go with the crowd.
Right. Doesn't go with the crowd. He also had great endurance. This is a book to a large degree, I think, about courage and endurance and idealism as well. We'll get to that later.
But yeah. We're talking with author Tracy Kidder about his extraordinary new book, Strength in What Remains. Let's try to take one quick question from Ali, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Ali, we might have to answer you in the next segment, but your question, please.
My question is, are we people from Africa who are fighting because of clanism, because of tribalism, are we learning from this young man and what he went through? I come from Somalia, where there is, the whole world knows what we're fighting for is for nothing. And the funny thing is, we are one homogeneous group. We have everything common, but we just come from a different, like, clan. We have the same religion, we have the same language, and I wish we Somalis will learn from this. And I would like to tell this to the colonial powers, if they would one day think about what they have done to Africa, dividing them into these lines and borders, and that caused this trouble, especially in Rwanda and Burundi, where you have both groups in both sides. My own country was divided into five. So that's why a lot of immigrants are now complaining about immigrants who they divided their country and they let them go through all this.
I'm with you, Ali. You're absolutely right. The whole origin of this awful strife in both Rwanda and Burundi, well, a good part of the origin was misrule by the colonial power, in this case Belgium. It was just extraordinary. They promoted what had been a social difference, and hardly the most important, particularly in Burundi, into something that it had never been and never was, which was a racial difference. And they did it in order to foster what was called indirect rule, so that they could administer these countries more easily for their own profit.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder. His new book is Strength in What Remains, A Journey of Remembrance and Forgiveness. Tracy Kidder is with me in the studio. And, Tracy, we're going to have another guest who I'd like you to introduce. You take us at the end. You go back to Burundi with Deo. He returns there even before he has finished his studies, to open a clinic. I'm not giving anything away here. And and Sarah are parts of that story.
What he did was, I mean, Deo is an American citizen, and he didn't have to go back to Burundi, but he did. And he partly to realize a childhood dream. And he, with a lot of help from Burundian friends and particularly American friends, whom he found on his own, raised the money from and so on. He has built a clinic and public health system in a rural village in Burundi, where, as you might imagine, after 13 years of civil war, public health is abysmal, if not virtually non-existent. And this clinic is simply a marvel. I like to think, you know, I think Deo, like all the effective idealists I've ever met, I think really wanted to build something larger than himself, and he has. He's not present anymore, at least for a little while, won't be present because he's continuing his studies. But the thing is that the clinic is running fine without him. It's I think 28,000 patients in its first year and a half. It's providing decent respect, you know, health care with respect to people who are unable to pay. It's really quite a marvel. It's a lovely thing. And my friend Sarah Broom, I gather, is going to join us. Sarah is the executive director of the sponsoring organization, which is called Village Health Works, villagehealthworks.org, I might say. And she knows a great deal more about the present state of the clinic than I do.
Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about the clinic, Sarah, in Burundi, I'd like to ask Tracy, we have not established how you met Deo.
Well, my wife and I had gone to visit Paul Farmer, whom I wrote about in Mountains Beyond Mountains. He had he was laid up after a knee operation, and Deo was there. And my wife talked mostly to Deo, and I talked to Paul.
And she told you his story
and the way back,
something?
Yeah.
So, Sarah, tell us about the clinic that Deo and others, you among them, were able to build there, and how has it changed things there?
Absolutely. So our clinic, Village Health Works Clinic in Kigutu, has the mission of helping to achieve health and also to bring quality health care to the people of Burundi in a dignified environment, as Tracy said. And I think the thing that I want to point out is when we receive the land. First of all, the land, the majority of it was donated to us by the community themselves. And when the community got word that there was the possibility of a clinic being built, they actually began building bricks long before Deo arrived with his friends from America. And so I think that the clinic, the way that I like to think of it is that the clinic, we are actually meeting the energy of the community because they were the ones, first and foremost, who said, we're in, we've got skin in the game, we'll start building the bricks. And in fact, they also raised 500 Burundian franc, which is about $50, which is a pretty big amount in a rural area of Burundi, and hired a truck to start bringing rocks to the land. So when Deo and his friends arrived, there was absolutely nothing there. It was bare land. And in fact, the only structure that existed was a police barracks that the community had built. And in fact, we turned that police barrack into our first inpatient ward. So as Tracy pointed out, 28,000 patients in nearly 2 years. Our inpatient ward, we now have solar electricity, which we got just a few weeks ago. You know, we've joined with friends in this country and in the U.S. to bring potable water to the area. So now we have a 15,000-gallon tank, which provides clean water to the community and the surrounding area. So we have done quite a lot in a very short time and with very few resources.
It's a remarkable story, and it certainly brings us full circle. Let's thank you for that, Sarah. Let's get some listeners here. Jacob is calling from Sharon, Vermont, and thanks for hanging in there, Jacob.
Hello, Jackie. Hello, Tracy.
Hi.
I wanted to share with you guys a story about Deo and his personality. I had a opportunity to meet Deo in person in Hanover, New Hampshire. And it was a chance meeting. We were sitting at a little cafe, and he sat down next to me. We started talking, and if you know Deo, he's a very, you know, sort of passionate and open guy, and he's very willing to talk. And we started chatting, and I was sort of complaining about trivial things in my life at the time. And he listened to my whole story, and then through the course of our conversation, I started to learn more about his background, and he shared with me some of his stories and immediately started to feel really sort of foolish for sharing these trivial things that I had talked to him about. And started to try to apologize to Dale for kind of being so trite. And he put his hand gently on my shoulder, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Jake, you can't compare suffering." And, you know, I haven't had the chance to see Dale again, but I look back on that interchange that I had with him, and it's been a really powerful, sort of moving experience for me.
Okay.
And I use that as a sounding board a lot of times to, you know, think about someone who's gone through these things and experienced these atrocities, yet still has such an open mind and a big heart.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Jacob. Well, Tracy, I don't want to say that I don't think anyone ever wants to necessarily believe that other people are saints. People have to overcome a lot of hardship. Sarah just gave us an illustration of what they've been working on.
Well, the whole saint business, which I encountered with Paul Farmer, does bother me because it really is a way of dismissing a person to call him a saint or her a saint. Can I just say one thing about the clinic and to back up Sarah's story about the community involvement? Partners in Health has projects all over the world now, but this little project, which is a sister project to Partners in Health, has more than any other, many people feel. And Dale was trying to get a road built up to the clinic, fix up the road, and he got a Belgian construction company.
That's a great story.
They wanted to charge $50,000 for it, and he came back to the village very despondent because there wasn't $50,000 to do that. And a woman at the village said, "Look, we may be poor, but we're not lazy." So they fixed the road with hose and, you know, shovels and rakes, and hundreds of villagers came out and just did it themselves. And the day it was finished, the Belgian construction company guy called Deo and said to talk about the price. And Deo said, "Well, thank you very much, but it's already done." And the guy said, "What? We're the only construction company in Burundi." And Deo said, "Not anymore."
Let's take another call. Rage is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Rage.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes, what's your comment, Rage?
Yeah, my comment is that there are lots of stories about ethnic conflicts in Africa, and I have experienced the Gacaca system in Rwanda, and wanted to know what lesson could we learn about this. And there are latent conflict in both these countries, Rwanda and Burundi, specifically between the two communities, Hutu and Tutsis. And what Dale and his group are trying to do to avert such things happening again.
Yes.
Okay, good question. And where are you from originally, Rage?
I'm from Somalia originally.
Okay.
Here's the thing. This village is 99% Hutu. 99% of the inhabitants are Hutu.
Which is not Dale's own.
And Dale's a Tutsi. Yeah. So far as Dale's concerned, this is absolutely irrelevant. And I think, you know, I know less about the Rwanda, but I do think that in Burundi, people are ready to set that, long since ready to set this aside. The great majority of people, I think the entrepreneurs of violence perhaps are not, but the real problems in Burundi are deep poverty, and it seems to me that promoting public health and, you know, building this model clinic and public health system can be a beacon in a country like that, a way to begin to put a shattered country back together. I mean, just one small way, but it does strike me as the epitome, a paradigm in miniature of what President Obama was talking about in Ghana, about, you know, mutual responsibility, partnership between the United States and the countries of Africa.
If I may add, one of the things we strongly feel at Village Health Works is that our number one aim and mission is to be able to do our work. And so for that reason, we stay as far away from politics as we absolutely can. In addition to that, we believe that peace and security are key components to having health. Mm-hmm. And when we say peace, we mean peace building. We mean the ability for people to go to sleep and their stomach not be growling or their house not be falling down. And so I think we do feel that through the work, through trying to create a healthy community, that we will achieve much within the country.
Well, sadly, recently didn't Village Health Works, you wrote about this in the New York Times, Tracy, lose one of its members and one of Deo's oldest friends?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Claude.
That's true. It was a lovely guy. Sarah knows a great deal more about this than I do.
Who he was attacked, Sarah, while he was delivering medicine?
Right. He was actually bringing our doctor and several nurses back to the clinic on a Monday morning at 9:30, they were held up, and he was killed in the process of that. And I just actually returned back from Burundi, and really, you know, we were all so terribly upset and devastated about this. But one thing I think became very, very clear. One was the need for the work of the clinic and the community. Tracy in his op-ed wrote about how shortly after the killing, the community actually formed a human barrier around the clinic, as if to say, you know, you have to come through us to get to the clinic. And in addition to that, we understand that we're in Burundi, which is a place which has been very much forgotten. We're in Burundi precisely because of that kind of violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, owe it to the community and to the work to make sure that our partnership with the government continues to be strong.
Okay.
And that they provide the kind of security we need.
Thanks, Sarah. Let's try and get another call in here. This is another Sarah calling from, I hope I'm not mispronouncing the name of your town, Saugus, Massachusetts?
Yes. Hello, Jackie.
Hi.
Hello, Tracy. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I have always liked it very much when they talk about Africa on the air, one way or the other. Unfortunately, it tends to be our sad stories, and we have many of them. We do indeed have the countries in civil wars, but we are 54 different countries, and most of us have never seen war before. Colonization really had its lasting impact on us, and it took a long time for most of these leaders, especially looking at Ghana when we were the first to get our independence, for them to wake up right from the bottom, way up, to give us education. Before colonization, the time of colonization, only 1% of Africans get education. Now, when you look at Ghana, it's 75%. Mm-hmm. Botswana, a small country in southern Africa, is 86%. A lot of progress have been made. But
is that the point that you wanted to make, Sarah?
Yes.
Okay.
The point is that these stories are good, you know, to hear, especially when they're able to turn around the tragedy into something good.
Okay.
That they did. Most of us would like to go home, but I think the cross of Africa problem now is not so much as us not working hard. I think it's the trade system. The trade system has to help us in our trade and economic budgetary with the rest of the world.
Okay.
And I think that's where Africa continues to lose and to add, and this adds to our problems.
Thank you, Sarah, very much. One of the things she pointed out, Tracy, was that a lot of people haven't seen war, but also something Sarah Broom was saying, that an individual can make such a difference.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think an awful lot of Americans think of Africa as a single big dysfunctional country, which of course it isn't. And it is true that we tend to write about the bad news from Africa. I didn't write a book about Africa. I wrote a book about a person who happened to come from a country that most Americans have never heard of.
In fact, when he lands at the airport, doesn't somebody say there is no such country?
Yeah. Oh, so she said, "Are you sure it isn't Burma?" But it's an important place. And it is also true that for more than a century there hasn't been it hasn't been the site of a lot of really good news, but there has been some good news lately, and some of it is thanks to the guy that I wrote about in part, and that's Village Health Works, and I tell about that in my book. So, I don't think that we can hide though from some of the terrible problems and they're not just in Africa. These are problems to a large degree. I mean, many of them finally come back to poverty.
Yeah. Quickly, Ms. Rock is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Just quickly, Ms. Rock.
Hi. I'm a social worker and working with a lot of immigrants from East Africa, mostly from Ethiopia. They are fleeing a political situation in Ethiopia. They have never traveled before, but they have all kinds of stories. But their aim is to come to the U.S. because of their positive experience that they hear about U.S. They want to make it here. They know they're going to make it no matter what happens. We have those kind of stories, but it's the hope that this is a place to be, you know, happy, free, and there's no problem. But even if there is a lot of problem, it's It's like they're going to deal with it. It's not worse, worse than what they had in their country.
Do many of them want to go back, Ms. Rock?
Not at the situation, but they want to go back. That's the goal. They will go back as soon as the political situation, you know, due to religion or political view.
Okay, thank you. Well, and you heard about someone who does go back, although he's not there at the moment, and but will be, I guess, returning when he can, even though he's
absolutely
an American citizen.
I have no doubt that he will.
Well, thank you so much for going back to Burundi and writing this book and being with us today. And Sarah Broom, we want to thank you too.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Sarah.
With the Village
thank
Health you. Works, the medical clinic started by Deo in Burundi. Tracy Kidder, it has really been an honor.
Really my pleasure, Jackie.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.